episode of the Pharmacy Preceptor Podcast. I'm Sarah.
I'm Ryan, and today we have a returning guest with us. Mark, do you want to introduce yourself for our listeners that didn't hear you the first time?
Sure, kind of like a bad penny, I keep showing up. Mark Bonfiglio, I'm the chair of pharmacy practice at the Gregory School of Pharmacy, Palm Beach Atlantic University.
And we're having Mark back as a returning, I'd like to say a returning champion of the Pharmacy Preceptor Podcast. The last time she was here, he talked a little bit about the COVID vaccine pipeline, and we're recording this on January 4th, and we now have two currently approved COVID vaccines. And it was of note that both these vaccines were the mRNA type. There's lots of different types of vaccines, but both of these early approvals were of that type. Is there a reason that we think that those happened faster than the other modalities, like the adenovirus or the inactivated? Is there something about that type of virus or that type of vaccine that made it quicker?
Yeah, it's really fascinating technology. They've been investigating mRNA vaccines for decades, and at one point sort of abandoned them because they really couldn't solve some of the problems of keeping them stable within cells or even getting them into cells effectively. And there were groups that started researching this, particularly back with the SARS and MERS cycles, that solved some of those problems, but they never really got to execute them in large-scale clinical trials. So when coronavirus 19 really kind of came on the scene, they were well down the path of having these solutions developed. So they could kind of kick into high gear very rapidly. And the elegance is the simplicity of these vaccines. It's just a molecule that you can synthesize in a test tube. You don't need to grow them in eggs or anything silly like you have to do for a lot of vaccines. You don't need to hollow out a virus and insert nucleic acids into that virus. You're just giving the strand of mRNA and allowing the cells to take that up and begin synthesis. So it has been felt to be the future of vaccines for a little while now. And we were very fortunate that the scientific development sort of was at a stage that made it viable to produce this once they had the genome for the spike protein.
Yeah, and I just full disclosure for our listeners, I got my shot about an hour and a half ago for my first dose of COVID-19. I'm doing fine, maybe just a touch of soreness. I'll let you know in 24 hours or so. But so I'm really excited to have just received my first dose. These vaccines, when they were released, there was a lot of hype, I guess. I don't know if hype's the right word, but a lot of excitement around the fact that they were 95% effective at preventing COVID. That was a relatively small sample size. Has there been any more data? Do we know enough yet to say if this is true in kind of the larger public?
Yeah, I don't think we have the data yet. You know, we're still in the process of seeing that inoculation, the vaccination process applied to large numbers of patients. I heard somebody describe this, that we are actually embarked on a very large phase 3 trial right now that's going to enroll millions of people. So there hasn't been a release of more data, but I'm sure that's what's coming, and we'll see that applied in different subpopulations more extensively. You know, the actual numbers in the trials were impressive in some ways. You're talking about 15,000 people in the active group and 15,000 in the placebo. But when you're talking about exposing, you know, large segments of the population to this drug, or to this compound, we're going to need a lot of vigilance over the next few months to track what's happening. 95% is a great start. Vaccine efficacy is judged as anything above 50%. So we're flying in the stratosphere right now. I wouldn't be surprised if the numbers come down a bit.
Just to follow up on that, because I know there's this new strain out there, the UK strain. Wanted to give you a chance just to comment on that and anything that you think our listeners should know about this newer strain.
You know, the concern with all viruses, and particularly with coronaviruses, is they are known to mutate. And you know, they are mRNA viruses, or they're RNA viruses. And RNA just isn't as stable as DNA. you think about where it shows up in the cells. You don't want RNA being used to synthesize the protein over and over again. So the body has a lot of reasons to chop it up very quickly. But that what that means is that the viruses themselves are going to mutate. And this particular mutation involves the spike protein, which has been the target of the vaccines to this point. There's a sense that, you know, a single mutation, amino acid substitution, you'd have to be really unlucky if all the antibodies that are generated by your vaccine would be directed at that one residue. And there is some preliminary discussion, I haven't seen any evidence, but preliminary discussion that the efficacy does not seem to be reduced, that the antibodies that are generated appear to be effective, which is good. But you could extrapolate and say, okay, that's one mutation. What happens when there's another and another? The mutation process isn't going to stop just because we want it to.
Kind of in the vein that we were talking about earlier, maybe it's probably too early for us to know about efficacy. What about side effects? I know it's really early too, but are we starting to see side effects that we didn't see in clinical trials? I know the major, somebody once described it to me as feeling like you had the worst hangover ever the next day. And between that and just the injection site reaction, those were kind of what's going on. Have we noticed anything additional, or is it still too early for that?
There have been a couple of reports that are of interest. A couple of what was called anaphylaxis. I like the older term, which was an anaphylactoid reaction or non-immune anaphylaxis. It's unlikely that this was an anaphylactic reaction to the RNA itself, but it could have been an anaphylactoid reaction to an excipient in one of the vaccines, something that's helped to stabilize the molecule. And those are, they're not immunologic in nature, but they do involve, you know, large amounts of histamine release and cardiovascular symptoms, and they're, you know, treated in much the same way. But that was probably the most troublesome, because as we start thinking about large-scale vaccination programs in non-traditional places, whether it's gymnasiums or even, to be honest, in community pharmacies, we have to really understand, do we have the equipment, the expertise to treat those kind of reactions?
Another question that I've gotten a lot, and I have two young boys at home, so this is one that I'm thinking about often. We know that kids are not currently, listed to be getting this vaccine. Have you seen anything on the horizon? Do we know about a vaccine for children or a timetable?
I have heard discussion, and I believe there are trial designs looking at children, but I think there's a general sense that children do not appear to be as susceptible to the severe forms, severe manifestations. So there doesn't seem to be much urgency to get the vaccines out there to children. And people are always a little reluctant to do pediatric studies if, you know, the risk and benefit of those things. And I think there's a lot of controversy about childhood vaccinations in general at this point. So I've heard that there are studies being organized, but I'm not really sure how far along that is.
Yeah, that's interesting. My husband and I were having that discussion, actually, I think maybe just yesterday, about that these vaccines aren't for kids. And I said, well, you know, the stuff that we vaccinate kids for is really a lot more dangerous than COVID is to kids. If you think about polio, MMR, those things are going to be more dangerous than COVID really is for the majority of children. Now, definitely there is that reaction that we're starting to see with some kids, but it's just not as big a deal as some of these other things that we vaccinate our kids for.
The only thing that I am sure is being considered is they're actually looking at dose, scaling back the dose for younger adults, like 18 to 55, scaling back the dose, particularly of the Moderna vaccine. But I think that's more of a measure to try and extend supplies than it is really trying to scale backwards so that, you know, when we get to the pediatric range, we have some idea of what a reasonable dose may be.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I just saw that this weekend, some conversation about having the dose of the Moderna vaccine to allow more people to get it. And I don't know how to feel about that. So I would love to get your thoughts on, you know, is that appropriate? Is there any detriment? What are your thoughts on that discussion?
I'm a little concerned about flying blindly into any large-scale vaccination program. And you know, the logic is there that we probably are overshooting with the amount of vaccine that we're giving, but we want to be sure in the older adults that we're getting the immunologic response. There's certainly some evidence that lower doses could produce an immunologic response, but that wasn't the dose that was used in trials. And if we're going to be evidence-based in our practices, we should follow the evidence. It's, you know, same thing in Europe, they're delaying the second dose of vaccine to extend the supply. And there's no data to say that that's safe or effective. But I think everyone is really starting to see the demand that's out there, and it's substantial. You see the lines, people lining up for this thing. And in one way, it's gratifying because we heard a lot of doomsday scenarios that no one would get it, but people are actively seeking out the vaccine and that they want to try and meet that demand as much as possible.
Did you have to wait a long time for yours, Ryan?
So I learned about it December 31st in Indiana. They opened it up to healthcare personnel who are directly treating patients. And I was able to schedule it very quickly. So didn't have to wait in line. It was really well run.
Well, and it does seem that the healthcare providers are receiving it in a relatively seamless way. It's when they've opened it up to try and get to the high-risk elderly populations that...
Yeah, I heard, and completely anecdotally, but I heard like a six-hour waiting line for elderly population, and police were called in to disperse the crowd.
It's being done on a county-by-county basis, so some counties are organized differently, but some counties are doing this first-come, first-serve, which means... just long lines and, you know, a vulnerable population sitting out waiting to receive a vaccine, oftentimes sitting outdoors. I feel like there has to be a better way.
Agreed. Well, Mark, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. I'd love to say that we'd have this all, you know, figured out in the next couple of months, but we might ask you back. We'll see where things take us. So thank you so much.
Oh, happy to be here. And thank you for the invitation.
Maybe we could have you come and talk about a topic that says not COVID.
Is there a topic that's not
COVID? I don't know. Not right now.
Not right now.
And thank you all for joining us for this episode of the Pharmacy Preceptor Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please like or subscribe. We would love your feedback on topics that interest you and how we can make this podcast better. Please submit your comments to help us develop content that best serves you. Thanks, everyone.